There's a time and a place for a fillet of fish. But breakfast is for sausage biscuits. McDonald's breakfast comes first. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
What does possibility mean to you?
That's a hard question.
Something that you can strive for.
That I'm able to do anything I set my mind to.
You're confident in yourself and you believe in yourself. Stuff that you could achieve.
I feel excited. Anything is possible when you're more confident.
Shoes are a huge part of that. They are the most important part of my style.
You can like express yourself
in the right shoes.
Anything is possible.
DSW, countless shoes at bragworthy prices. Imagine the possibilities.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
This message is sponsored by Greenlight. With school out, summer is the perfect time to teach our kids real-world money skills they'll use forever. Greenlight is a debit card and the number one family finance and safety app used by millions of families, helping kids learn how to save, invest, and spend wisely. Parents can send their kids money and track their spending and saving, while kids build money confidence and skills in fun ways. Start your risk-free Greenlight trial today at greenlight.com/iHeart. That's greenlight.com/iHeart.
You are listening to continuing coverage of the trial of Chad Daybell from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast. Let's go back to the courtroom.
All right. Thank you. Please be seated. All right. We'll have the jurors return, please.
Yes, sir. Thank you. I've got some, but thank you.
All right, please.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Bailiff. Please be seated. All right, we're back from the mid-morning recess. I believe we've got the issue sorted with the jurors' monitors. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, in attendance here for moving over to the other side of the courtroom so that those monitors aren't visible. Ms. Blake, if you'd like to continue with your direct, you may do so.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I had asked to publish, I believe, States 295D. I'm going to change that to publish 295J. It's a previously admitted exhibit.
Okay, 295J, previously admitted, may be published.
Thank you, Your Honor. Dr. Christensen, as part of your review of documents provided in this case, do you recall reviewing photos that were taken at the scene of Tammy's death?
I do.
And Judge, I am flying blind here if this is being shown or not.
It is.
Thank you. Dr. Christensen, on that photo, can you see something coming out of Tammy's mouth?
Yes.
Can you describe what we're seeing there?
Yes, this is foam, essentially. It's what a manifestation of pulmonary edema. You can see running down the left side of her face what looks like blood. Pulmonary edema fluid, as it comes up, is edema fluid is just fluid that leaks into the air spaces when it normally should be contained in blood vessels. And as it leaks into the air spaces, normally there is protein and other things within those air spaces to help keep them open. And as the fluid gets in there, it mixes with that protein and creates this bubbly, frothy fluid, which can then bubble up through the airway and out the nose or the mouth or both.
Can there be several causes of pulmonary edema, or what ultimately causes that, or is it a result from?
Yes, pulmonary edema, again, I think I said previously, is a nonspecific finding that can result from any kind of insult to the lungs. We certainly see it in asphyxial cases. We see it in drowning cases. We see it in the setting of heart failure. We see it in the setting of drug intoxications. Those are probably the primary places where we see it, although really anything that causes respiratory failure can ultimately cause pulmonary edema to manifest in this way, pneumonias and other things.
Did the presence of the pulmonary edema also play into your findings in this matter?
Yes.
And we've talked about Utah being a medical examiner system. So you yourself or another medical or forensic pathologist will respond out to a death scene in Utah, generally speaking?
In cases where the pathologist will respond to scenes where there is a homicide or suspected homicide, or in any case where we're requested to by law enforcement at the scene or our other investigators at the scene.
Do you know in Utah if someone responds out on unattended deaths?
Yes.
And is that generally someone from your office, whether an investigator or otherwise?
Yes, it's one of our investigators in most cases.
If you had seen the pulmonary edema, is this a case in which you would have had an autopsy performed?
Given the amount of information that was provided at the scene, what was relayed to me as what was shared at the scene, there's not an adequate explanation or sufficient medical history to explain her death at her age in a sudden and unexpected way without doing an autopsy examination.
I think we've gone over this a little bit, but when you did the internal part of the autopsy, did you notice, was there anything out of the ordinary in relation to Tammy's organs?
No.
Was there anything?
Except for her lungs, sorry.
And can you explain what was out of the ordinary with her lungs?
Her lungs were a little bit on the heavy side, heavier than would normally be expected, and had fluid in them. There were also changes related to her prior embalming.
Had you conducted other autopsies where pulmonary edema was present?
Yes.
Is pulmonary edema by itself actually a cause of death?
It's not.
Would it be the result of the cause of death?
Yes, it certainly could be. So if someone has pulmonary edema because they drowning would be that. If they have pulmonary edema because they have heart failure, because they've had multiple heart attacks, then the underlying cause of their heart attacks would be their cause of death. But all of those kinds of things, anything, lots of different things can result in pulmonary edema.
And is pulmonary edema generally a manifestation or finding associated with asphyxiation being the cause of death?
It certainly can be, yes.
And we've talked a little bit as well about your review of the external part of Tammy's body. Do you recall that?
Yes.
And you'd referenced the only external injuries you had seen were some bruises.
That's correct.
And Your Honor, I have what's been marked as State's Exhibit 179. If I can have counsel handed a copy, and I have a courtesy copy for Your Honor, and then I would ask that the witness be handed a copy.
Very well.
And Your Honor, this exhibit is some blank diagrams. My intent is to have it handed to the witness and have him add some markings to it.
Very well.
May I have the witness handed a pen?
Thank you.
The exhibit's not yet admitted, Ms. Blake, and I understand because if it's going to be altered, just think of when that would take place if you're offering it.
Thank you, Your Honor. Dr. Christensen, would you mark on that diagram where the bruising was located on Tammy Daybell's body?
Yes. Okay.
Thank you. And have you marked those based on your recollection of where you observed those injuries during the autopsy?
Yes.
And Your Honor, I would move for the admission of State's Exhibit 179.
All right. The exhibit now with the markings, I think it would be appropriate for defense counsel to see what the exhibit now looks like before I ask if there's any objection. All right, Mr. Bailiff, if you'd please submit that exhibit for reference to Mr. Pryor.
Your Honor, now that counsel's been shown a copy, I would move for the admission of State's Exhibit 179.
Okay, and I apologize, I lost track. Where is the exhibit at this point? Did you retrieve it?
I have it. Would Your Honor like to see it first?
No, that's fine. I'll ask at this point. Thank you, Ms. Blake. Is there any objection to Exhibit 179 being
If it's admitted? Being offered for demonstrative purposes, Judge, I don't have an objection.
Okay, Exhibit 179 will be admitted as a demonstrative exhibit. Ms. Blake, you may inquire.
And Your Honor, I would ask permission to publish.
You may publish.
And Dr. Christensen, you can see on this exhibit, there's an R and an L that's been written in. Would you indicate what those represent?
Yes, those simply represent the right and left sides of the body. And at the bottom, I also indicated which was the front and which was the back, although that's fairly obvious.
And then it appears that there have been several dots or markings added. Could you explain what those represent?
Yes, they are not to scale, but they are representations of the locations where we identified bruises.
And on the front, there appear to be six dots. Is that correct?
Yes.
And then on the back of the body, four dots?
That's correct.
And you've already indicated they're not to scale, but can you talk about and put into the record where on the body these bruises were located?
Yes. There's one on the left upper chest. Three over the anterior and lateral right biceps, one on the anterior right forearm, one over the anterior portion of the left biceps, two over the right triceps area on the back of the upper arm, and two on the back of the right forearm.
Did you discover any bruising on the lower extremities?
We did not.
Did you discover any bruising around the head or face area?
We did not.
And did you, in fact, take photos of the bruises that were observed during the autopsy?
Yes.
You talked before about the difficulty in determining the age of a bruise by simply looking at it. Is there something else that you did in this case to try to determine how recent the bruises occurred?
Yes. As I mentioned, just the visual appearance doesn't necessarily indicate to us how old a bruise is, but we can at least attempt to narrow that down somewhat by looking at the tissue and the bruise under the microscope. Blunt injuries of the body undergo a relatively orderly progression, although certainly not very time specific in a, you know, to the minute or even to the hour sort of way. But initially, when there is an injury, you see just hemorrhage in the tissue, then that will be followed some hours later, can be as early as two, might be as many as, you know, 12 or even 24 hours. You will then see inflammation start to enter the area to clean up the hemorrhage. And depending on the severity of it, you may then also see what are called macrophages that come in and start to clean up some of the broken down blood cells. You may see the formation of scar tissue if it's significant, and that goes through a progression from early what are called fibroblastic cells in the area, which are just the cells that make scar tissue, which then eventually become replaced by the scar tissue itself. And that allows us, seeing what kind of changes are present in an injury, can give us an indication whether this is, you know, recent, meaning, you know, minutes to hours old, whether it's hours to days old, or whether it's days to weeks or even longer old. But more specific than those sort of broad swaths of time, we can't narrow it down.
We talked about during the autopsy, photos were taken to document the injuries.
Yes.
Were photos also taken of examination done of the injuries?
Yes.
And Your Honor, I have what's been marked as State's Exhibit 178 A to Q. Counsel was provided a copy today.
The series of photographs, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. It's a series of photographs taken during the autopsy. And I believe the witness has been handled that jump drive. I would move for the admission of State's Exhibit 178 A to Q.
And there would be no objection by the defense to that exhibit, Judge.
Okay. So Exhibit 178 A through Q, those are, it's 178 is the exhibit. A through Q are individual photographs within the exhibit, and they're all admitted, Ms. Blake.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would ask to be handed that jump drive back. Your Honor, I will indicate these are graphic photos. I am going to be asking to publish them to the jury.
Very well. We'll have those published. And as I mentioned, we've had the monitors arranged so the public's not viewing those and they're not being streamed on the live stream.
Dr. Christensen, do you see that image on your monitor?
I do.
Can you tell us what we're observing here?
This is the bruise that's on her left chest.
And in this image?
This is a closer up image of the same injury.
And can you talk about, there's a little scale there. What is the purpose of putting that on the photo?
Just so we have a reference to the size of it. When you get zoomed in, especially in a picture like this, it's sometimes you can't always tell exactly where you are or have a reference point to know what size something is. So we include a scale so we have a reference.
And in this photo, can you talk about what we're seeing?
This is an incision through that area of bruising.
And can you talk about why you did that in this particular case?
And it, with all of these, looking at the tissue, like I said, microscopically will give us some idea what they look like. So this is a prelude to having a sample to look at under the microscope. But it also confirms there are things, for example, certain dermatologic conditions and other things that can look like a bruise on the surface. But when you incise them, there's no evidence of hemorrhage in the tissue. So in this case, we can see that there is hemorrhage in the tissue.
And in this particular photo?
This is, again, a photo of the same area with the a tissue section removed that demonstrates the hemorrhage placed into what we call a cassette. That little white plastic thing is that that tissue that is placed in there is then taken and processed and turned into a microscopic slide that I can review under the microscope.
Ms. Blake, on these, would you care to identify each by the sub-exhibit letter, if you don't mind?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And the first one that was referenced of the chest is going to be 178A. The close-up of the chest is 178B. The first incision is 178C. And the most recent one that was referenced would be 178D with the slide showing an excision of the chest.
Thank you, Ms. Blake.
When you looked at this, what, if anything, did the, I think you used the term hemorrhage, what, if anything, did that tell you in relation to this bruise?
That it is a bruise. Just looking at it grossly doesn't necessarily tell us much, except that there is hemorrhage there. And then seeing it under the microscope gives us further information about that.
And then moving to 178E, can you... 178E, can you tell us what we're seeing in this photo?
Yes, this is an excision of tissue of the bruise of the left biceps.
And again, in those excisions, were you able to determine anything in relation to whether that was a bruise?
It was. Yes, there's hemorrhage within the subcutaneous fat. Normally, an excision of skin will just show a layer of normal pinkish tan skin on top, and all of the fat beneath it will be a bright yellow color, like is evident in most of those sections, but there are also darker areas indicative of hemorrhage.
And then on this slide, what are we seeing here?
This is a closer up image of the same injury and same excision.
And Your Honor, this is, we moved on to 178F.
All right.
This is 178G. Can you tell us what we're seeing in this image?
This is a photograph of the two bruises on the back of the right upper arm.
And moving to 178H, can you tell us what we're seeing in this image?
Yes, this image depicts the three bruises on the right biceps as well as two on the right forearm.
And there are some other markings there, it looks like, on the forearm in addition to those blue marks. Do you know what those marks were?
Yes, those are areas where mold had grown and had we'd subsequently cleaned that off.
So those are not bruises?
They are not.
And then moving to 178J, can you tell us what we're seeing in this image?
This is a closer up image of the right biceps demonstrating the bruising there.
178K, can you tell us what we're seeing here?
Again, this is an excision of the tissue of the lower of the three injuries to the right biceps with the excised tissue in the cassette.
And what did that tell you when you did, when you took that excision?
Just shows us more hemorrhage in the tissues.
And did that indicate to you that those were in fact bruises?
Yes.
And 178L, can you tell us what we're seeing here?
I believe, actually I'm not positive looking at it, whether that's the same as the last image.
And if I back up to the last image, yes. if that has the letter B at the end on that white slide, does that help in reference?
Yes, this is just a close-up image of 178J, I believe, the immediately prior image.
And when we look at this one, it appears that there's more of that dark coloration. Can you explain what that would indicate?
Just that there's hemorrhage in a larger area. of tissue.
Would that be indicative of a larger bruise or a deeper bruise, or could you tell?
I mean, it's clearly both deeper and larger in terms of the area that's damaged.
And moving on to 178M. Oops, back to the right image here. Looking at 178M, what are we seeing here?
It's labeled L on my screen, I believe. It's the right forearm with two bruises.
And going to the next one here, what are we seeing in this image?
This one is labeled M and is a closer up image of those two areas of bruising.
And those are again on the right forearm?
Yes.
And then moving to 178N, can you tell us what we're seeing here?
Yes, this is an excision through one of those two bruises on the right forearm.
And what, if anything, did this excision tell you?
Again, confirms that it's a bruise, that there is hemorrhage in the skin and soft tissue.
And then moving to 178P.
This is an image of a bruise on the anterior forearm, right forearm.
And then moving to 178Q.
Again, a closer up image of that same bruise on the anterior right forearm.
178O. This is marked as 178O. Can you tell what we're looking at here?
Yes, this is the right forearm with an excision through that area of bruising.
And that was on the front of the forearm?
Yes.
And Dr. Christensen, were you able to make any kind of a determination as to when in time those bruises may have occurred?
They all showed evidence of hemorrhage in the tissue with no evidence of any sort of inflammatory response or cleanup response. So they would have occurred sometime from minutes to hours prior to her death.
And I think you indicated, but these would have occurred prior to her death. Is that correct?
Most likely. You certainly can bruise a deceased body, but generally speaking, that's not going to occur for a very protracted period of time once circulation stops. Mostly the types of blunt injuries that we see in people that have already passed are more things like lacerations, where a body might be dropped or something of that nature. But it certainly could have happened right around the time of death.
And when you look at the location of those bruises, in your training and experience, could they be consistent with someone being restrained?
They could be.
When you looked at Tammy's body, did you notice any signs of lividity?
Yes.
Could you explain to the jury a little bit about what lividity is?
Sure. There are a number of postmortem changes that a body undergoes after death. And lividity is one of them. It's also called livor mortis. It is pooling of the blood, which normally has been circulating through the body under pressure. Once that stops, gravity then takes over and kind of pools the blood in whatever is the most dependent portion of the body, the part closest to the ground. If a person is laying on their back, the areas where it is supported by, you know, whatever, a bed, the floor, a chair, whatever it might be, will not demonstrate lividity, but areas around that will fill with blood, and it makes initially a sort of a reddish purple color. That is where the blood is just pooling. It can change over time for a few hours. It's one of the ways we have to look at whether a body has been moved after death, for example. But if once it's there and well established, usually by 12 hours or so, it won't change anymore. And it will stay in the position it was in, or that person was in, if they stayed in it for 12 hours. If they're moved prior to that time, then it can also move to where a new position. If someone dies, for example, on their back, stays there for a couple of hours and then is rolled to their front, that blood that had started to pool on their back will then start to pool to their front. And over a period of, you know, the next 10, 12 hours or so, depending on how long a person stays in their initial position, if you move them after 2 hours, more of that blood will redistribute than if you move them after 6 hours, than if you move them after 10 hours. And at some point, and at 12 hours is not a hard and fast thing, but at some point that lividity becomes fixed and will not change no matter what position they get moved to.
Where did you observe the lividity on Tammy's body?
It was all on her back. And because she'd been embalmed, it had changed somewhat in color. It was a little bit more gray in color, but the distribution was still very typical.
Just to clarify, does lividity allow you to determine a time of death?
It does not. No.
Can you talk a little bit about what rigor mortis is?
Sure. Rigor mortis is one of the other sort of three postmortem changes in the body. Lividity is one. Rigor mortis is one, and then cooling of the body is the third. But rigor mortis is a stiffening of the body that happens after death. Initially, when a person dies, they will be flaccid or just completely floppy and not show any muscular resistance. But within an hour or two, they start to become stiff. Initially, we see that in the smaller muscle groups, in the hands and the face and other places, but it will progress to involve all the muscles of the body. Will become, you know, essentially very solid, and very difficult to move, after a period of hours. And then once it's fully developed, which is somewhere, you know, around 12 hours also, it will stay that way until the body starts to decompose. And then that, you know, can vary dramatically depending on where the person is, if they're in a cool environment, if they're in a hot environment, if they're next to a heater, you know, all of those kind of things can change how fast decomposition ensues. But once a person becomes fully stiff from rigor mortis, they'll stay that way until they start to decompose.
Can you determine a time of death based on rigor mortis?
So we are asked pretty much usually only in the context of court testimony to discuss times of death or how long a person might have been dead.
Judge, I'm going to object at this point. This is becoming narrative, and I've tried to be patient, but the question called for a yes or no, and we got this narrative. So I am going to object.
Dr. Christensen, can you explain how rigor mortis would play in or not play into determining a time of death?
It can help us, depending on the degree that it is present or not present, to look at, you know, how long a person has been dead, but it's highly variable and imprecise.
And as a forensic pathologist, do you generally determine a specific time of death?
No.
Does the presence of rigor mortis allow you to narrow a time window of when someone may have passed away?
To some extent, yes.
In this case, did you learn what time Tammy's death was reported?
Excuse me. Yes. My recollection, it was sometime just prior to 6 a.m.
Had you learned or heard the description with regard to the condition of Tammy's body?
My recollection is that she was described as being cold and stiff or cool and stiff. I don't remember which, but at the time she was found.
Based on that description, would it indicate to you that rigor mortis had set in?
Yes.
You were not present on the day of Tammy's death. Is that correct?
I was not.
You did not, is it fair to say you did not get the benefit of viewing her body just after the death was reported?
That's fair, yes.
So as a medical examiner and or a forensic pathologist, do you rely on external information that's provided?
Yes.
Does that external information assist in your forming an expert opinion regarding a reference to when the person may have died?
Yes.
And in this case, did you in fact gain that external information?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And were you able to come up with any kind of an estimate regarding a time of death in relation to Tammy?
Judge, I'm going to object at this point. It calls for speculation. His previous testimony confirms that. It would just be purely speculative for him to.
And Your Honor, if I may respond.
Respond, please.
He's an expert providing an expert opinion. He's already said he reviewed documents. He gathered information. He made a determination that rigor mortis would have set in given the description and information provided to him. So he's basing it off the information and forming an expert opinion.
And in response, Judge, he wasn't present at the time. He didn't observe those factors himself. He's relying on what the police have told him. And at this point, he can't make that estimation.
All right. I've considered the objection. I am going to overrule the objection, finding it's proper in the form of an expert testimony. It will be subject to cross. So you can proceed with the question again, Ms. Blake.
Thank you. Based on the information provided to you and your experience, did you form any opinion in relation to a time of death or a time window in relation to Tammy's death?
Yes.
And what did you determine?
That she had likely been dead for at least an hour or two for her body to be described as stiff, but certainly could be much more than that, many hours. But it's unlikely to have been more recent than an hour.
And you did review medical records in relation to this case, is that correct?
I did, yes.
Would someone having anemia or a past history explain a sudden death?
It would depend on the degree and the severity of anemia, but if it's not a current problem, no.
Would someone using essential oils or treating themselves with items bought at a health food store generally explain a sudden death?
No.
And we talked about those bruises and saw images of them. Did those bruises and their location play into your findings in this case?
Yes.
And again, in a negative autopsy, you looked at the other potential reasons or causes of death that could result in a negative autopsy. Is that correct?
Yes.
Based on your experience and training, did you find it to be likely that Tammy Daybell died of a seizure?
No.
Based on your training and experience, did you find it likely that Tammy Daybell died of a cardiarrhythmia?
No.
Based on your training and experience and lab results, did you find it likely that Tammy died of an intoxicant?
No.
And when we're talking about the negative autopsy, what did that leave as the cause of death?
Asphyxia.
Your Honor, if I may have just a moment.
Yes.
I have no further questions.
All right. Thank you. All right. Mr. Pryor, you can cross. Can you turn on the microphone, please?
Let's do that again. Judge, by stipulation of the parties, I'll move for admission of Exhibit 102 and 103. That's Defense Exhibit 102 and 103 that represents the autopsy. And then the first one is the 26-page autopsy. 103 would contemplate the additional pictures and some analysis as well by this witness.
All right. The defense has moved for admission of Exhibit 102. Does the state have any objection to that being admitted?
Your Honor, it's my understanding that that is the autopsy report created by the Office of the Utah Medical Examiner. And if that's what it is, in addition to some lab results and other findings, the state has no objection.
Okay. So as I understand, there'd be no objection on 102 and 103. If and when those become published, if they are, Ms. Blake, if they're not what you anticipated, let me know and we'll quickly review that to make sure they are the exhibits you believe have been admitted. So those are admitted, Mr. Pryor.
Okay. And Doctor, you mentioned that you're retired as the chief. Was it the chief medical examiner out of Utah?
Yes.
And that's out of Salt Lake City, is that right?
Taylorsville, but Salt Lake County, yes.
And I'm not familiar with Utah, so is that close to Salt Lake City?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. The government hub of the state of Utah, is that right?
Hmm.
Okay. I want to talk to you a little bit about the initial cause of death reported for Tammy Daybell, and it did say pulmonary edema. Is that correct?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you were able to confirm that through this autopsy as well, correct?
I was able to confirm through the autopsy that pulmonary edema was present, but right. not that it was the cause of death.
Okay. Now, when we talk about pulmonary edema in this particular case, can you tell me how long would it have taken to produce the kind of pulmonary edema that you found during the autopsy?
I don't know.
There's no way to determine that.
No.
And there's also no way to determine whether it had advanced or whether it had declined. You exhumed Tammy Daybell's body and you have to report the facts as you see the facts at the time upon the exhumation, right?
That's correct.
And at this point, you had initially indicated that you went in front of you were present when a hearing was held in front of a judge to make a determination as to whether or not they would have exhumed Tammy Daybell. Is that right?
That's correct.
And do you recall from your knowledge what was the reason for the exhuming the body at that time?
My recollection is it was to determine the cause of death.
Well, there had to have been some facts. You don't get to just dig somebody up.
Your Honor, counsel's testifying. Move to strike.
Sustained.
There has to be a reason at the hearing to determine why you're exhuming.
Your Honor, counsel's still testifying.
Sustained.
Isn't it true, Doctor, that there has to be a reason for the exhumation and not just be to re-examine findings? Is that correct?
I would assume so, yes.
While you were present, what was the reason given for digging Tammy Daybell's body back up?
I don't recall specifically what was presented.
Okay, so what was the purpose of you going there if you don't remember why they dug her up?
Objection, Your Honor, argumentative.
Same.
Do you recall whether or not there were discussions about surrounding circumstances that could have influenced a decision to exhume?
I believe there were, yes.
Okay. And those circumstances that they justified for exhuming were the death of Charles Vallow, right?
Objection, Your Honor. Counsel's testifying. The witnesses said he doesn't recall.
The fact is those additional circumstances that you based the reason to dig Tammy Daybell up out of the ground was because of the death of Charles Vallow.
Objection, Your Honor. Counsel's misstating. This witness was not the one that requested the exhumation.
Stain.
Do you recall whether or not there was a discussion about the death of Charles Vallow at the exhumation hearing?
I do not.
Do you recall whether there was discussion of Brandon Boudreau at the as a basis for the exhumation of Tammy Daybell's body?
I also do not know.
Okay, so you don't remember any reason, is that right, for why they decided to dig a body up out of the ground?
Objection, Your Honor, argumentative, and it's asked and answered.
Stained.
You don't have any explanation that you recall as to why they dug Tammy Daybell's body up out of the ground, do you?
Objection, Your Honor, argumentative and asked and answered.
Overruled on that.
You don't have any...
He gets to answer, though.
I think I said previously my understanding was to determine the cause of death.
Okay. But you don't specifically remember the factors as to why they dug her up, right? That were offered to a judge?
I don't remember the specifics of the discussion.
Okay. And you don't, now, you talked a little bit about Utah. And from what I understand, you can do it by request of the family. Is that right? Or you can do it by request of going in front of a judge and giving justifiable reasons as to why you would dig a body up out of the ground, right?
I believe that is the way the statute reads.
Right. And in this particular case, the family was never notified, right?
Objection, Your Honor, calls for speculation and irrelevant.
Overruled. If the witness has information, he can answer. And I want to hear the answer.
To my knowledge, the family was not notified.
Okay. So in other words, then the other side of the statute is that you went in front of a judge, not you, but someone went in front of a judge and got an order to exhume her body. Is that right?
Yes.
And to your knowledge, even though you were present, you don't remember the facts that were presented.
Objection, Your Honor, asked and answered.
Sustained.
Okay. Now, you made a comment in your autopsy that you performed, and you noted that the bruises were what are called very nonspecific bruises. You remember that?
I don't recall the specifics of how I described them in the report. I'd be happy to look at it and refresh my memory, but I don't. So bruises by nature are nonspecific.
Okay. And you recall testifying last April and May in another proceeding in which you, in response to a question, I described the bruises as nonspecific, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And when we're talking about nonspecific bruises, what that means, isn't it true? What that means is that you can't identify the cause of those bruises. Is that correct?
A specific cause, no.
Right. In fact, you can't tell how those bruises ended up on someone's body, correct?
That's correct.
All you can tell is that the nature of those bruises and whether they're bruises, right?
And I can offer opinions about how they might have been inflicted, but there's a wide variety of those.
But in this particular case, you said they're nonspecific, correct?
Even nonspecific bruising can have multiple potential modes of infliction, yes.
Okay. And in this case, you identified the bruises as nonspecific. We've established that,
yes.
Correct? And you can't tell me how those bruises were placed on the body of Tammy Daybell, correct?
I cannot.
Or how she got those bruises?
I cannot.
And the reality is we can go back as far as 24 hours, and those bruises could have been 24 hours old. Isn't that true?
Potentially, yes.
Or 12 hours true, right?
Yes.
And we can't even put a legitimate time as to when those bruises actually got, or she incurred those bruises on her body, correct?
Beyond the time frames we've spoken of, no.
Right. And in addition, you didn't speak to any of the family members, the immediately family members, about these bruises on Tammy Daybell, did you?
I did not.
You didn't talk to the family about any medical history that Tammy may have had about treating herself for bruises, did you?
I did not.
You didn't look at any of the reports or any of the medicine from the time of her arrest in which there was a notation about bruising cream that Tammy Daybell was using, did you?
Could you repeat that? I'm not sure what you mean.
Did you see any medicine that indicated Tammy Daybell may have been treating her bruises with bruising cream?
She had a number of ointments, creams, oils, and other things at the residence, which we, those that were documented in photographs by the coroner, we did look up and go through.
Okay. And so you, and based on history, in speaking with the family, you weren't able to get any information about whether or not Tammy Daybell was prone to bruising, correct?
I did not speak to the family.
Okay. Did you look at any other statements by Mr. Daybell while he talked about vomiting and fainting and falling over? Do you recall looking at those factors?
I did not see statements directly from him, but he was quoted as talking to various officers and others at the scene about those things. Yes.
And that leads into my next question, is that the information you got about what Tammy Daybell reported was given to you by police officers, not necessarily statements Mr. Daybell made. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So if we recap a little bit, we don't know why we dug Tammy Daybell up out of the ground, right?
Objection, Your Honor. Counsel's testifying misstates the evidence. Same. And move to strike.
We got an exhumation order to take Tammy Daybell out of the ground because you were there for that, right?
We did.
Okay. You don't recall the reasons why you got the exhumation.
Objection, Your Honor. Ask and answered.
Sustained.
Okay. So you talked a little bit about Utah, and then you talked a little bit about Idaho and how in Idaho, it's up to a coroner to determine whether or not there's an autopsy that needs to be performed. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And in Utah, it may be a little different, right?
It is.
You talked a little bit about how it's not ideal to conduct an autopsy after embalming and burial. Would you agree with that?
It's certainly not ideal. Yes.
Right. I would agree with that. And Judge, could I, I need the exhibit and I'll get the number, Judge. I'm sorry. I think it's 179. Judge, I'd like to republish exhibit one. Judge, I'd like to republish exhibit 179.
You may.
Best laid plans, right? So we're looking at exhibit 179. You recognize that those are your dots, aren't they?
They are.
So when I look at that, how many bruises are on the right arm of Tammy Daybell?
8.
And there are 3 on the front, or 1 down at the bottom, right?
4 on the front and 4 on the back.
Okay. And then how many total bruises would be on the left arm?
1.
And then how many bruises up on the chest area?
1.
So you talked about asphyxiation, and you made a determination that there's asphyxiation here, right?
Yes.
Okay. And what you're suggesting is that Tammy Daybell was, someone stopped her from breathing, right?
Correct.
Okay. So I guess what I'm confused about is, how is someone asphyxiating Tammy Daybell if there's one person holding her arms?
Objection, actually withdrawn.
You can answer.
I wasn't there, so I can't tell you the specifics.
Right. And the other question is that if someone was holding her arms down, how did bruises get on the front of the arm and on the back of the right arm?
You can have bruising on front and back from a grab.
Okay. And then that person would also at the same time be grabbing the lower part of the right arm too at the same time?
Not necessarily at the same time, no.
Okay. And then while they're asphyxiating her, they grab the left arm, and there's only one little bruise on the left arm, right?
There is one bruise on the left biceps, yes.
And then at the same time, somebody puts something over her mouth while they're holding her arms to suffocate her, right?
It could have happened that way.
It could have, right? It's possible. It could also have happened that this wasn't asphyxiation, right?
I don't believe so, no.
Okay. You're firm on this idea that you think it's asphyxiation, right?
I do.
And that determination you made is as a result of just talking to the police, and after you did this investigation, correct?
Objection, Your Honor. Misstates the evidence.
Sustained.
There's more to come in the trial of Chad Daybell. Press subscribe so you don't miss any of our continuing coverage right here from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply. You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply. You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply. You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply. You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply. You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply. You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
This message comes from Greenlight. Ready to start talking to your kids about financial literacy? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app that teaches kids and teens how to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest with your guardrails in place. With Greenlight, you can send money to kids quickly, set up chores, automate allowance, and keep an eye on what your kids are spending with real-time notifications. Join millions of parents and kids building healthy financial habits together on Greenlight. Get started risk-free at greenlight.com/iHeart.